This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Right On, showcasing the work of Otago Southland writers. I'm Beverly Martins. Join me for news and interviews with local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon till 1 and replayed the following Sunday at 1pm. Right On is brought to you by the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and kindly supported by the great team at the University Bookshop.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Hello and welcome to Write On, brought to you by the Otago Southland branch of the Society of Authors in partnership with the University Bookshop. I'm Beverly Martins, and this month we're focusing on the Dunedin Fringe Festival, which opens tonight and runs for the next 10 days. Now, it's a really full and exciting program of comedy, drama, poetry, music, dance and happenings. Many of the events are free and all the rest are affordable. So I urge you to get along and see something surprising and delightful. In fact, many writer friends may well have the Yellow Hut by Ella West, which is on at the Globe, and or the Trapeze Artist featuring the poetry of Hone Tuwhare and Cilla McQueen, which is on at Hanover Hall. They'll probably have those on the top of the list. But for me, personally, it's all about theatre. Now, because my first guest wears so many hats in the space, I'm just going to call her a professional theatre maker and world famous here in Dunedin. So, Cindy Diver, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me.
Now, we're talking primarily today because the Dunedin Fringe Festival opens tonight and you're directing a theatre piece within that called Labbies 2. So let's rip straight into the what, when, how of that.
Okay. Labbies 2 follows Labbies 1, which we did in the 2019 Fringe, I think it was. They are plays written by Ruth Carraway, who's an amazing playwright. She's Essex, born and raised, and then she moved to New Zealand probably 15 years ago. She's actually heading back. So this her swan song.
Yes. We're very sad to lose her. Absolutely.
She's amazing. Anyway, so the play has the same two actors that we did in their first, and this is 10 years later in those two women's lives, set in the same toilet in a crappy nightclub in Essex.
Because Labbies is the English
that's right. Yep.
Vernacular, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So it's a comedy about friendship and comedy drama about friendship and it's a lot of women's issues in the 40s that come in. I'm going to wink, wink, nudge, nudge, and women who are in their 40s plus will know. And about moving on and how friendships change, I guess.
Now it's you're holding it, putting it on at
Maggie's. Down
cafe.
On Stewart Street.
Yeah, so what are the challenges of that kind of?
Site-specific is always a challenge, but since we've lost our main theatre, don't even start.
No.
Since we've lost our theatre, we've had to get used to the idea of using non-theatre spaces to try and create the same magic. So we've had to build a totally portable set and have lights and everything that we rig up each night and de-rig each night.
Oh, of course, because it's working cafe again during the day.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah. So there's an hour, an hour before and an hour behind just rigging and de-rigging our set and lights.
Yeah.
But Maggie's have been brilliant. They're so happy to have us in there and it's a really, really supportive environment. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Now, look, you've been in the game a long time.
Are you calling me old? I am old.
30 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
Forming your theatre company, Theatre Works, back in the early 90s, still going today, mm-hmm. established the Simulated Patient Development Unit, mm-hmm. SPDU, which uses real actors to simulate real symptoms to help medical students with diagnosis and treatment, still going today.
Mm-hmm.
And then the actors agency that you had for a number of years, which I understand is a bit of a mixed blessing because, of course, many of your clients then leave Dunedin to sort of pursue wider opportunities. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Yeah. We were actors agents for about 10 years. and we had 120 actors probably at our peak that we were finding and creating work for. And we didn't just do it for film and TV, it was for corporate shows and for other things as well, making productions to keep these actors working and in Dunedin. But at the end of the day, in order to do their craft, they would need to leave. Mm. Wellington and Auckland are quite parochial when it comes to casting, and so a lot of the ones who actually wanted to go on in their work needed to leave, and so we were constantly refilling our staple. Mm. And at the end of the day, nowadays, I usually say to young actors, look, I'd love you to stay, but I know you've got to go.
Mm. Yeah. And it's a bit, in some ways, because of the theatre program at Otago Uni and stuff, it is a bit of the nature of the beast, isn't it? I'll go and watch things at Allen Hall and I'll make a note of a couple of people and think, you know, on my radar, can I use them in some way? You must be the same.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The Theatre Studies Department has been a wonderful creative womb for New Zealand, I think. A lot of my friends, because I went through the university department as well back in the early 90s, and a lot of my friends who went through that project, went through theatre studies, are still acting today is in the industry. So it is a really good starting point. And so the people that you go and see, yeah, they're going to be something someday. Sure enough, there they are.
Mm. Yeah, but it's networks too, isn't it? That you can, you know, sometimes there's an opportunity to pull them back in.
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, like some of the people that I have worked with on some of my tours have been people that I went through university with, and I was like, I'm going on a tour. Do you want to come and play? And they'll go, yes. And so I've dragged them back.
Brilliant. Now, speaking of things going on tour, you've done some really standout verbatim theatre projects, including The Keyser and The Margarine, which is about dementia, caring for or having dementia, which is clearly just as relevant, you know, that play today. And that toured widely, didn't it?
So yeah, for about 9 years we toured New Zealand on three separate occasions, four separate occasions. So, yeah, that was a play I'm extremely proud of, yeah.
And it's probably still got legs, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, it will always have legs because the stories won't change. The experience of dementia and how it affects the carers and the people living with it is universal, and until we can find
sadly
a cure.
Sadly increasing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, I mean, you've done so many things, so I'm really just picking out the highlights, as it were. Lockdown was you had a lockdown like no other in terms of, you know, because a lot of people I've talked to creatively couldn't write a thing during lockdown. You know, they were just lying on the couch and overwhelmed. You kind of took the opposite approach. One was quite a specific one, which was I think we're almost, to me, the personal becomes political in that you had a family setting in a living room of not an actual family, but a created family, living out the lockdown through the various levels, all in this one confined space of the living room. So people coming and going, having highs and lows. Do you want to just talk about that, Cindy?
Yeah, that was actually opened at the Fringe, well, I'm going to say 2021. Mm. And we took over a shop front on, actually just below here, actually, just on Princess Street. And we built a house inside the shop front so that the audience was standing outside nice and nice and safe in little circles that we chalked on the pavement so they could stand at a distance from other people. And they watched through the window in a kind of a voyeuristic way, one family living through the entire 2 years that we'd just lived through in 22 minutes. Mm. Well, actually, no, 18 minutes and 39 seconds, that first one. And so it was to try and get people to remember how far we've come and what we endured to have the freedom that we did by that point in 2021.
And also what we didn't know, you know, like the bringing in of the groceries and the kind of, you know, the
experiences,
the fears,
and
the processes that
homeschooling, holy moly, who would have thought?
Yeah.
And all the things that families, and we, when we wrote that, I wrote it, and we collaborated with the actors and talked about their own experiences and what for them were pivotal. And then it was like picking out those pivotal moments and getting our family to experience that so that the audience outside could re-experience it, but with the catharsis of
it being over.
Yeah, the time and distance.
And the relating thing, you know, like the mother and the son doing the, you know, the online aerobics and stuff. I mean, you know.
The teddy bears in the window. There were so many things that we did that as we were doing them, we go, oh, my God, And using the 1 o'clock briefings as like the hook, which it was for all most of us, really. It was that you knew where you were at one, where were we, what was the numbers, all of that kind of thing.
What was happening? What were the instructions?
Yep. Yeah. And we did feel, and I did try and pose it positively, because this is prior to the riots the following year, about the idea that what we did for each other, and we need to be able to remember and celebrate that. You know, not for...
That can get lost in the rhetoric now, can't it?
In the politics. Yeah. You go, actually, you know, the guesstimated 20,000 people didn't die because of what we did. And you go, that's... people's grandmothers, people's aunties.
Yes, that's it. Which kind of leads on to your second lockdown project, Random Acts of Art, which sort of grew out of you having an inkling, an idea of how you could kind of spread kindness, connection and hope, and a whole lot of costumes that you had from various productions, including a dinosaur costume, which is, I understand that the sort of genesis, and it just grew and grew, didn't it? But it was kind of you donning a dinosaur costume, putting a dog collar on, and asking your son to take you for a walk.
Well, that came before resilience, because it was during lockdown. And because we were locked down and in the bottom of my house, I have my props and set. Well, some of the props and set. And we would go for walks and we would watch the fear on people as you cross the road to give each other space. And that sense of
what do you mean the fear? How do you mean what would you see?
You'd watch people trying to keep distance from each other, trying to connect but not knowing how to. And where I live out in MacAndrew Bay, we've got a lovely walkway along the beach, along the harbour, and you'd watch people doing their walk as almost a chore rather than a joy. And so I thought, well, I could do it in something silly. And
so you could disrupt it, basically.
Disrupt it. The idea of breaking the routine. Mm. What is Cindy going to wear today? and you could walk past houses and have people leaning through their lounge window laughing their ass off. I had almost had a truck crash because he leaned out of his truck to scream I was a good effing something and gave me the thumbs up.
So high praise.
I started thinking, what else could I do downstairs within the rules to create stuff that would make people laugh? So I had giant butterflies and flowers and unicorns and other things that we did. And my son, who's a fantastic little cohort of mine, he's only 13 now, but he was 10 then. He was like, okay, I'll help. And he and I would go and do stuff. On Easter, we chalked the pavement with eggs because, like most people, the supermarket was terrifying and the idea of trying to get eggs. And so I dressed up as the Easter Bunny and chalked the pavement. And we bumped into a couple of little kids and I was like, why can't you give us eggs? And I was like, oh, I can't get to the supermarket this year, but I'll tell you what, if you look in your Christmas stocking, maybe, wink, wink, I'll come back for that. And these little kids were like, thank you. Thank you, Easter Bunny.
Meanwhile, I've just got to hop away now.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I did ridiculous stuff that made my poor husband, who's an introvert, extremely embarrassed. But,
Actually, let's talk about that, Cindy, because this is what I love about some of these things, and listeners, you can, you know, go and look this stuff up on YouTube. It's these summaries of it, and it is just completely heartfelt and charming. So go and have a look at Random Acts of Art on YouTube. But what? Getting back to my point, I mean, you're not afraid to make a dick of yourself,
no.
And I just find that, you know, as a woman and as you get older and, you know, we can be quite self-censoring. So how did you get over that fear and embarrassment, or have you just never had it? I mean, is this kind of a combination of 30 years of, like, where does that come from?
I don't know. I think as an actor, you do silly things for money all the time. But I think probably in my 30s, I started giving less of a damn. And I think...
Did you find that very freeing?
So freeing. Mm. Was that everyone in this world has their own opinions, and they will think what they're going to think regardless of what you do. And
You mean if you play by the rules, you're still going to get it wrong in some people's eyes?
Totally. Yes. And for instance, when I was in dinosaur costumes or doing some stuff, I remember I got into a Triceratops costume in Alexandria to go to the hairdressers, where my friend who owns that hairdresser said there's a wee boy who really loves dinosaurs. And I said, well, I'll see you in 10 minutes. And I turned up in this inflatable dinosaur, massive triceratops, huge head. Anyway, the kid loved
it. Sorry, but you walk there. I mean, how do you get that even in a car?
Why don't you deflate it?
Oh, right.
It's deflated, okay. Then you zip it up and you turn the fans on and it inflates. And then as I was walking in, there was this woman walking towards me and I was kind of like dancing and being all, you know. Mm-hmm. And this woman just stared straight through me like my existence was an offence to her and she was going to not be in any way
amused. Or
I'm not amused. This is Alexandra. We do not do this kind of stuff, whatever this is. Yeah. And I remember thinking, oh, love, sweetheart, life's too short.
Yeah.
But that's not her jam.
Yes, and you don't know what was going on in her head or what her
situation was, but the fact that the little kid enjoyed having a dinosaur turn up and pretend to cut his hair was hilarious.
Yes, job done, tick. Yep. Yeah. Now, are you doing less things and obviously, as I say, not lolling on the couch and locked down with a face cloth over your face?
I don't have a choice in lots of ways. I think the thing about being a creative and being a parent during lockdown is that we never had that choice. And I think a lot of my other colleagues who are parents as well, when you've got a young person who's feeling the fear of what we all felt back then, and you've got the desire to try and lighten that load.
Right.
And you're creative, you go, well, how can I creatively lighten
that
load?
You lean into it.
You lean into what you know to try and make sure. Yes. I mean, I'm terrible at maths and I'm not very good at homeschooling. Oh, my goodness. But I can create stuff that makes people feel lighter and breaks the routine, makes them laugh. And
gives you joy.
And it gives me joy
on
giving
the way.
Them joy.
So that's a lot of giving, Cindy. Mm-hmm. How do you kind of recharge? Like, what do you, are you an active relaxer? Do you go out kayaking on the bay? I mean, how?
No.
Oh, steady on.
Oh, no. A walk on the bay.
Yeah, but how do you? You know, that's a lot of one way traffic in some ways. I know you get something back, but you know, there's a lot to do, and
people fill me up. I love
you get your energy off people and off their reactions.
Oh my God, creative people. Yeah. My friends are some of the cleverest creative. I've got a book club full of amazing humans. And my actor and theatre practitioner friends, you know, half an hour with them just refills your tank because you fill each other up with the joy of life and that
plus
sense
you get
of,
it. You know, you get each other because you know that this is not an easy life to choose.
Yeah.
So, you get it. Actually, I've just come back from an amazing workshop at Playmarket.
Yep.
On Saturday, all day, very intense, 6 of us, but same thing, just, I mean, you can kind of get that thing of being equally buzzed up and kind of running on empty at the same time.
Yep.
That's a common thing to feel, and I think when you're creating.
Especially like in rehearsals for Lavies, which we've been rehearsing for the last 3 weeks, I will go to rehearsals kind of like thinking of all the things that need to be done, but by the end...
Things you need to fix, kind of.
Yeah, how to craft it. And then you come out of it just feeling so full of the joy of watching these amazing women do their work and knowing that the product is actually just going to sing. And you're like, yes.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's really great. Now let's just quickly talk about your own projects, your own writing projects that are quite current for you, which was because I saw this at the Otipoti Theatre Lab back in October. There was 3 plays by local playwrights, including yourself, which was your rehearsed reading of your new play Wahine Matatoa.
Mm-hmm.
So just give a quick recap on that experience and then also where that's at the moment.
Like, well, it's quite funny. The Wahine Matatoa, the mostly true story of Irahapiti Pātahi, is my first attempt at a full-length play. I've written so many plays over the years for my acting classes, for interact acting classes, for my actors in those that I'm training my students to work on. And I've never really given myself permission just to sit down and write something for me. And this story's been in my in my soul, I guess, since I was a child, because I'm a direct descendant on the matrilineal line from the title character. And so I've always heard about her stories, and I've always thought it would be a great play, but I've never given myself the time to actually sit and do it. And last year I took two months off to recharge and to look after my whānau, and in that time I sat down, I thought, I'll give it a crack. And then the fantastic people at Utaputi Theatre Lab said, well, do you want to come and board on this project? And it kind of gave me a deadline I had to actually do it by, and there was something wonderful about that, knowing that you can't just leave it. It has to actually get to the point where someone can stand up and do a rehearsed reading of it. And from there we...
Plus you had Albert Bowles as...
Oh, Albert's great. Yeah, Albert and I got on so well.
Yeah.
We then applied for funding from CNZ Toi Māori Fund to do a development season this year, and we received full funding for them, as well as the DCC Professional Arts Fund. And so this year in June we are going to do a four-week rehearsal process where we're going to integrate Juanita Hepp as director, H.J. Kilcally as producer, four in the cast, and then there'll be tanga poro, there'll be lights, there'll be sounds, there'll be AV, there'll be projections, and it'll be taking it right out to the max of what we can do, with an idea that maybe touring it next year. So it's pretty exciting to be part of that process.
Absolutely. Now, we're kind of running out of time, but I'm sure that, I'd love to have you back on another show, because you've always got kind of something in the pipeline. How do you kind of keep going? Because it's not easy being a creative this far south.
No.
You're kind of off the main highway.
We always have been. And I think that's one of the things I love about the local creators, is that we're used to being proactive and doing it on a dime, because we don't have the stable foundations that some of the other cities have. And so we all help each other, and we all gift our talents to each other to help keep it working. And I think that's the thing that keeps me going, is that the community of creatives here are so wonderful and giving, that that if we don't keep that aroha going between us, then it will fall down, and the only thing that will be available to the public will be Netflix. And let's not stop telling our stories.
So it's kind of keeping the flame burning.
Yeah, ahika. Yeah. It's keeping the flame burning here until, she said, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, DCC helps us build a new theatre. And I can't stress how much a new theatre that is purpose-built is important, because it could be an art centre for more than just theatre. It can be dance, it can be touring shows, it can fulfil all our boxes. And I think if we can get that, then we will have a heartbeat for our city again.
But meanwhile, keep on going, keep on doing what you're doing. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So all the best for Labbies too. I understand the sales are fantastic, and five performances opening
tomorrow night.
Yeah,
on Thursday night. We're actually sold out. But if you want to come along, give me an email. There's an email on the website where you normally book for a ticket, and I'll see if I can get you on the waiting list.
Fantastic, Cindy.
Okay, thank you.
Well done. So now, in deep appreciation of all the tremendous mahi that Cindy did during lockdown and beyond, I'm now going to play a song by a Kiwi R&B duo, Sisters Underground, aptly called In the Neighbourhood.
City. It's so damn hot and my neck is feeling gritty. I gotta find something to do, cause if I don't pretty soon, I think I'll go loo-loo. Every day seems like the same old thing. Listen to the brothers talking about the damn Mac-10. I gotta roll, cause I got a feeling. I gotta keep the sound of the underground reeling. And I'm out like bell-bottom trousers, fruity, funky, chunky, dropping beats by the hour. And you know, the sisters on the boulevard don't give me props, they're just too damn hard. Stroll right past them, roll right past them, even though they talk crap and make me wanna blast them. Because I'm chill, I have to keep subliminal, cause I know my enemies are white collar criminals.
Rolling in the neighborhood.
never really understand what I mean. I'm telling you, child, I got a major dose of funk. I'm sick with the flavor of the thick chocolate stuff, but a pessimistic attitude can get in the way. So when the night comes, all you wanna do is play. So we roll to the club to see if we can get it on, even if we don't know how we're gonna make it home. 'Cause once on the floor, we can really shake a booty, shaking all our troubles away, doing the duty. Going on, keeping on till the break of dawn. Come every Friday, and I could've sworn I seen the same guy in the same shirt, 1 to 4. Had some trouble with the guys at the door, 'cause everywhere we go, it's like a show. You gotta watch your back, because you never know.
Rolling in the neighborhood.
Welcome back. You're listening to Right On with me, Beverly Martins. Of course, March is also Pride Month, and the Fringe Festival is held in collaboration with Dunedin Pride, who have their own sets of events literally across the road from us at the community hub in Princess Street. These include arts and crafts sessions, a poetry night, and 2 different leadership panels featuring prominent members of the Rainbow community, including MPs, city councillors, and the Honourable Grant Robertson, who share their experiences of being out in public life. One of the panellists is Dr. Chris Brickell. Now, Chris is a professor of gender studies at Otago University and has published several books on social sexuality, particularly the history of gay men in New Zealand. I spoke to Chris last October in his capacity as co-editor of the Robert Lord Diaries. So I'm going to replay that interview now in honour of Pride Month, and also because Robert Lord is arguably the founding father of contemporary New Zealand theatre, and his former cottage here in Dunedin just continues to support writers and playwrights through residencies to this day. So here's Chris Brickell talking about Robert Lord. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Beverly.
So I guess my first question is, I mean, diaries are pretty personal, so why did you want to publish Robert's diaries?
The trust that oversees the diaries had a few requests from people who were interested in Robert and a feeling that there's a bit of resurgence of interest in him, and this seemed like a good time to put this out there. Robert talks about his diaries as both personal but also something that he was depositing with the Hocken Library in Dunedin. So they're in a public library, so we thought, well, it would be quite nice to get them out there for people to have a bit of a read about. And my own interest in this was getting a gay playwright who hasn't been talked about much recently out in the public spotlight, and because the diaries are so amazing and because they're so personal, they're so interesting.
They are. They're a real mix of kind of, there's a bit of who's who in there, not that he's trying to do that, because these are just, you know, people he knows.
Yeah.
But there's quite a social history of sort of New Zealanders in New York at the same time as him too, isn't
yes.
there?
Yes, there is. So playwrights like Roger Hall, for instance, went over to New York to visit Robert. And so there was a bit of a, New Zealand community over there, and there are lots of other names that I didn't recognise.
They were kind of passing through.
And George Webby, for instance, who was based in Wellington. And so there was a sense of a kind of a connection between the New Zealand artistic life and an expatriate or visitor artistic life in New York, which is kind of cool. And then famous people like Meryl Streep was in one of his plays, for instance, which is kind of fantastic.
So I guess the other thing too that interested me is that you're one of three editors for the book. So there's Vanessa Manhire and Nonita Rees as well. Now that's quite unusual to have three editors, isn't it? And how was that process of you working together? Like, you know, how did you claim your
goodness. Well, it worked incredibly well because Nonita knew Robert. She knew him really well. She was involved in Play Market with him. In fact, she helped him set it up. And she acted in one of his plays, and she was a good friend of his. Vanessa's an editor, but she also spent a lot of time in New York. And so we had different areas of expertise, and so this worked perfectly. Vanessa pursued the New York connection, and there's quite an extensive set of footnotes in the book where Vanessa was tracing people through. Nonita and I worked on a list of his plays. I wrote most of the introduction and did most of the photo research. So we actually all took a little bit of the project and split up what actually was quite a chunky amount of labour between the three of us.
Quite complex. Looking back now, you probably think, actually, we needed three of you.
Thank goodness, is my memory of it. And we got this out fairly quickly because Otago University Press had a publishing slot. So we were working over Christmas. We were working pretty intensively on this. And it kind of got bigger and bigger because as we found friends, we would find some more photos, and as we found who someone else was, then we'd discover their ex-partner or ex-flatmate. So it was quite a little network.
Did you then, I mean, there must have been things that you actually couldn't physically fit in the book. Did they then go to the hawker? Like, did the archive generally about Robert expand because of this?
We have discovered a few things that will go to the hawker. But the Hocken archive is incredibly extensive, so it's got multiple versions of his play scripts. Excuse me. It's got an enormous photographic collection. It's got the diaries. It's got some short stories. It's got treatments for film and movie projects, some of which happened, some of which didn't. So, the Hocken is a Dunedin treasure, right? Mm. And it's got a very extensive Robert Lord archive. It's a wonderful archive.
And I think it feels like you've sort of busted it open and let people know that now. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a real, what we focused on in the book was his life a bit more than his work, although we weave his work into it, and I read over 20 of his plays in order to try and get the context in my own head, because I wasn't very familiar with Robert before that. But there's material in the Hocken that will allow people to do a really careful analysis of his playwriting if they choose to do that. So there's more in the Hocken archive than we have used.
Of course, yeah. Mm. So what do you think what was some of the key things that you learnt about Robert in editing this book?
I think one of the things that interests me, in a sense, is the tension between someone's personal private persona and their public persona. Mm. So he comes across in many parts of the book as quite hesitant about himself and his relationships and his work, but in public, I gather he was quite garrulous and confident. Yeah. So there's that sense of someone having another inner life that you don't always see in public, but that a diary gives you access to. And I think, I mean, I'm quite interested in what moving from place to place means for people. And so there are a lot of New Zealand authors, including Dunedin authors like Charles Brash, for instance, who have this sense of moving from one place to another and becoming someone different. Mm. So the sense of who was the New York Robert and who was the New Zealand Robert and who was the Robert who lived with his parents in Auckland and who was the Robert who found a place in Dunedin, a city which he really loved, even though his relationship with New Zealand was quite tense because New York in the 1970s and 80s was such a vastly different place from Te Puke and the place where his family lived and Paiatu and so on.
Yeah, it was quite schizoid, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I guess probably because he writes about more of those things in New York. You know, there's the kind of party boy side of things. And then here, you know, and that's quite a culture clash from... He didn't really, I'm not sure, but he didn't really seem to be quite out in New Zealand, did he? I mean, he did amongst his theatre community, but not perhaps personally. Is that right?
I think that's a fair way to put it. He talks about his parents and his parents' friends, particularly his parents' friends and relatives, asking him what life is like in New York. And he says, shall I tell them about the really racy bits? No, I won't. I'll lie about that. So there's that sense of a bit of a double life and a bit of holding back.
Yeah,
I think that's right.
And I think he was a very considerate person too. So I think he would probably think of... Yeah. You know, the impact on people. Because he did go from one place to the other and, you know, he probably thought, well, you know, I'm going to go back to New York, but these people, you know, my family isn't. So, I think there was sort of that. Something that really struck me is that I think one of the entries he described himself as manic depressive, which was kind of the phrase back then is, I guess we use the word bipolar now. But do you think that was true, or do you think that was just the age-old struggle between having money or needing money to live while you're trying to create work? Because that just comes through time and time again, isn't it? He's, you know, the phone gets cut off, he's behind in rent, and he just continually, it's a struggle. So I think that, you know, the impact of that on your creativity is as much as anything. So I'm not sure where you sit on kind of that.
I'm not sure either, because there's that one mention in the diary, and when you mention to people that he described himself in that way, they seem a little surprised. So I'm not sure, but that about the manic depressive aspect, but the juggle is so much there,
isn't
you
it?
Know. He would get in a bit of money and then, you know, he would pay it out on bills immediately, then he'd have an airfare, film company would say, come to New Zealand and do this project, and then he'd get here and they cancel it. So
he was often travelling, hopefully, wasn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
He went to LA for a while to try and find some work, but nothing really much came of that. But then I think one of the things about Robert is that his most successful play was Joyful and Triumphant, and that was put on after he had died from AIDS. And so that was terribly sad. And I've had a careful look through some of the rewritings of some of his plays, and they become more conventional as he works his way through the different iterations. And I wondered if that was to make them more
commercially acceptable.
So try
and get more in sync with the New Zealand audiences of the time, maybe.
Yeah,
I mean, I've got to say that Joyful and Triumphant is still my favourite Robert Lord play. And I love that they often play it on national radio at Christmas time. And I didn't, until I read the diaries, actually realise that the working titles were either the Christmas play or the Boxing Day play. But I just love that 40-year span in the family and the real changing thing between kind of the, you know, the kind of blue ribbon, rural sorts of things, and then life just changing and social mores changing and where they kind of end up. And there's quite a shift, isn't there?
Yes, there is a real shift. And I had wondered for a while how Robert seemed quite in tune with New Zealand politics of those different decades. And then I discovered he had a political science major in his arts degree.
Right.
So that explained that. But there are these sort of awarenesses of the context, which he was quite good at. And things like there's one character who has a relationship and a child with a Maori man and then lives with a woman for a while. And there's this kind of fluidity of identity that's quite a Robert Lord theme. And that sense of the tension between traditional society and emerging forms of social life and mores, that's a real Robert theme as well. So it speaks to themes that are really strong right the way back through his the middle of his playwriting career, back to his really quirky and fascinating early plays as well. That the theme of suburban life, to what extent does suburban life impose conformity on people and to what extent can people escape it? That's an incredibly strong Robert Lord theme that runs through pretty much every play.
And I just think that thing behind the curtains, you know, you know, you can look down the street and things can look very serene and whatever, but you don't know. You don't know
has this
what's going on. the different houses.
You don't write. And he has this wonderful piece about Christchurch where he says that Christchurch was incredibly empty, but there must be a lot going on behind the curtains,
right,
behind closed doors.
Yes.
And so Christchurch in particular struck him as being a place where the intricacies of life and the complexities of people's emotions all happen behind closed doors.
Well, I mean, you know, it's probably the most English of our cities.
Yes.
Or it certainly was back then.
Yes.
Right, so one of the key things that I'm, you know, we're all forever grateful for is him co-founding Play Market,
yeah,
which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And I just, I'm a member of Play Market, and I just got the annual just last week, and I just want to read a couple of things because this particular annual focuses on the kind of history of Play Market. This is just a little excerpt that they put into the annual. The very first company meeting took place around Robert Lord's bed in a tiny flat on Clifton Terrace. Judy remembers that he had a particularly nice patchwork quilt. And then, back in the 70s, another snippet. The first royalty check came in 1974 for Robert Lord's balance of payments, apt title, at the Hawera Repertory. It was for $2.50, and Play Market took its clip of 25 cents. You know, so that,
yeah,
just shows, like, such ground roots. You know,
yeah,
it was a group of passionate people. It wasn't,
yeah,
like any kind of grants or structures or, you know, it was just like, we need to do this, we need to give the New Zealand voice. It's,
yes,
a bit like Charles Brash founding,
yes,
Landfall, I think, in a way.
It is, isn't,
yeah,
it? There's a real parallel there. Two things. One, the quilt was probably made by his mum, who actually, in some of his photos, he makes notes that his bed coverings were created by,
yeah,
his mother. So that's the first thing.
Yeah.
The second thing is balance of payments, which is an extraordinarily wonderful and completely kooky play in which two parents send their son out as a rent boy, and when the son brings home insufficient amounts of money, his mother stabs him to death with her knitting needle, and then, in trying to cover up her tracks, she then shoots the vicar and a client of her son who turned up at the house, and it's just extraordinary.
I mean, you'd have to see the play because
it's
to
wonderful.
Describe the, you know, to describe the plot is just, you know, you can't even get your head around it.
You can't even get
your head around it.
No,
but it's amazing how theatre can make that, can take you on those sorts of journeys, isn't it?
Yes,
yeah
absolutely. And as a really early play, starting with his key themes of, you know, what does it mean to conform to society's expectations as a mother or a son or a father. So, you know, he starts off that conversation really early on.
Mm. And then I guess, the diaries, they end in 1991, which is,
yeah,
the year before his,
yes,
death. But there's, you know, he's pretty candid about what's going on with his health,
yeah,
and trying to get the right medications and things over,
yeah,
here, because there are more things available to,
yeah,
help in the States than there are here. And there's this desperate sort of time where he's waiting at the mailbox for like 6 weeks or something,
yes,
for some,
yes,
AIDS drugs things.
Yeah. But he doesn't want his mum to know.
No, yeah,
so
he's down at the letterbox.
That,
yeah.
Hoping to intercept it,
yes,
before she, you,
yeah,
know, she finds out. So there's a,
yeah,
sense of the kind of family secrets. And, you know, she was at his bedside a lot when he was dying. So so there was a, you know, there was definitely a way of talking about it there. But it's incredibly sad. And the last kind of piece of the diary, he's driving back from Christchurch, where he's been for treatment for the brain tumour that he had.
Because
he
couldn't get it in Dunedin.
Because the machine was broken,
yes,
and
yes,
the hospital wouldn't admit,
yes,
it, I think.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, he's kind of driving down with the grass flashing past along the roadside, thinking,
yeah,
about how he wants to get what he was at that point calling the Boxing Day play done. And he does.
But he doesn't get to see
But he doesn't get
to
see
the production of it, which is, yeah, which is really sad. And also, I guess, I was about to use the word upside, and that's not the right term, but he did know that he, you know, his health was failing, and,
yeah,
he was terminal. And so,
yeah,
the kind of, with that, he had the grace to sort of organise his life, set up the cottage,
yes,
in Titan Street as being, you know, something for the future,
yeah,
for things like that. So,
yeah,
do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So the cottages are the the building he described as the smallest house in the Southern Hemisphere, if not the world.
Yes.
And he was involved in setting it up with his brother and Nonita and various others as a trust for visiting writers. And I think one of the things that comes through when you talk to friends of Robert's is how incredibly generous he was to them and to the writing community and to the art of writing. So it makes total sense that he would then want his cottage to be set up to continue on that support of writers, because he was a very supportive person.
And a very collaborative person.
And very collaborative,
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I don't know that, I can't remember the... I used to know it when I did my walking tours, but I think it's at least 500 or more people have had access to that cottage over the years, haven't they?
It's
enormous
number.
It's sort of 25 years. Yeah, and I mean, this summer we'll have the University Bookshop. Summer writers and residents will come and stay there for 6 weeks, and you know,
almost always full. I think that there's so often someone staying there, and there's actually going to be an open day on the Sunday after the book is launched, so
Fantastic. People
have a chance to come.
Oh, well, look out for that. And for those of you who don't know, outside the crake in the Octagon, there is a tiny little plaque on. In amongst the cobblestones that denotes the founding of Playmarket in that where the new Athenaeum Theatre is now. Mm. So, you know, that's a lovely full circle thing.
Yes.
Yeah, so there's a little brass plaque. And, of course, Robert's got his plaque in the Octagon as well. So we've kind of talked about who you think the book's for, but do you want to just sort of reiterate who you think it's going to appeal to and why?
I think there's a number of different kind of groups of people who'll be interested in the book. I mean, it's a story of an expatriate writer and a writer more generally, and he talks about the struggles of writing and the process of writing. So writers, I think, will find it interesting. People who are interested in the history of theatre in New Zealand, because it contextualises his plays and puts them in relation to the work of other playwrights like Roger Hall. There's a real gay history here. And talking about what it's like to be a gay New Zealander, both here and in New York, and to be going backwards and forwards, and thinking about what that means for your identity. And there's a bit of an AIDS history, which is something that's really, there's not much in New Zealand about people's experiences of living with HIV and AIDS in the 1980s. Mm. It's an oddly sparse kind of literature. And it's also just a really good read for people who enjoy diaries and learning about, you know, people's inner lives and the way that they relate to the society around them. He talks a bit about New Zealand in the 1970s and 80s, about the impact of Robert Muldoon, for instance, on the shaping of New Zealand culture. So there's also a history of New Zealand politics and culture and the relationship between those two things. So it's a multifaceted book, I think.
Fantastic, Chris. Thank you. And it will be available... from now at all good bookshops, including, of course, the University Bookshop, for $45, published by Otago University Press. Thanks very much, Chris.
Thanks, Beverly.
And that's the end of our show. So look forward to seeing you again next month and talking to you then with some more writer interviews. In the meantime, keep reading, keep writing. And for goodness sake, go and support your fellow creatives at the Fringe Festival.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.